This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hello, everybody. It's me again, Toni Quest, and welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe. And I always say it, I appreciate the fact that you actually take the time to sit and relax and listen to these great interviews, these great people that I interview. I have the most interesting people on the planet on my show, and it makes this one of the best jobs I've ever had. But tonight we have a great guest, someone I've met in my own neighborhood, so to speak, but yet he seems to be quite worldly. His name is Derek Wright, and he's actually a filmmaker, an author. He's retired. I don't even know if he's retired. He's a police officer, and I really appreciate him for everything that he does because he really speaks to something deep inside of us all if you really pay attention. I was fortunate enough to see one of the films that he made, and I'm going to talk to him about that and also about what his plans are for the future. So, Derek, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's interesting. I know that you have a show also on cable TV, and I have seen it once in a while, and you have some great guests as well. So I have to consider you a colleague in that way.
Yes, thank you. And the same director, we share the incomparable James Brooks.
Yes, with our director, who's, I say, it's like our private genius. We're very fortunate to have Jim Brooks. But anyway, back to you, Derek. I just want to say that I find your background very, very interesting, and there's a couple of things I'd love to talk to you about. The first thing is I want to talk about the books that you've written. I know you've written a few, and I know one of them, I believe, you made into a screenplay. The film I saw, was it originally a book?
No, actually, the film you saw was just a script that I had written in about a week, just from a couple of ideas in my head, a story that I've heard, and the 9/11 tragedy that I was involved in. I kind of melded all three together and came up with When the Dust Settles. That was never a book. That was just a quick screenplay.
Wow, very good. It's almost like you wrote a quick historical fiction, you know, in a screenplay. It was a very intriguing movie. I remember, well, I'm going to let you tell it. The plot took place on 9/11. And tell the audience a little bit about it, because I want them to have the opportunity to perhaps see it after our interview.
Well, the plot took place on the morning of 9/11. We're dealing with our protagonists, Tamara Salazar. She is a New York City detective. And her husband, Xavier, was a New York City uniform cop. They've been having their struggles as far as their relationship is concerned. And some harsh words were exchanged between them on the morning of 9/11, which led Tamara to go to work, leaving Xavier in bed. And she went to work very heavy-hearted. Now, on the way to work, she's listening to the radio, and she heard all the broadcasts coming in from the 9/11 site, you know, pandemonium, of course. She figured she and her husband would both be heavily immersed in the tragedy, so she called him. When he didn't pick up, she got concerned. She called him repeatedly. He didn't pick up. So she turned around and went back home. Now, upon arriving at home, she saw a car in the driveway, which she paid no mind to because her husband's partner seldomly comes to pick him up. But on this day, when she came inside the house, she heard music emanating from the bedroom.
Ooh.
She went up to the bedroom and found her husband and her husband's partner in their bed.
Wow.
To make matters even worse, her husband's partner is another man.
Uh-oh.
Said again, that just took it to another level.
Yes.
So, of course, she was very upset when she walked through the door, saw them, you know, asked her husband Xavier why, and the worst thing that happened was the boyfriend wanted to speak up. And he said a couple of things to her that really ticked her off, as if she couldn't be pissed off anymore. So she pulls out her service revolver and does the unimaginable and executes them both.
Both of them?
Both of them. Right there in the bedroom. So now she's stuck with two dead bodies in the bed, and she's actually at the point where she's about to execute herself. She's about to commit suicide because there's no way back from this. The phone ring startles her, and she just got an epiphany. On her way to work, she spoke to Clem, who was the neighborhood gardener, and he had mentioned something to her about a wood chipper, which he dropped off in her backyard. She looked out the window, saw the wood chipper, and all of a sudden her wheel started turning. And she's like, I can get away with this. So she takes both of their bodies, places the wood chipper towards the lake in her backyard, throws both of their bodies in a wood chipper, and it shreds their bodies into the water. She cleans herself very well because she's a detective. She knows what forensic scientists look for. So she cleans up very well, cleans the scene up, takes all the clothes, gloved hands, and her husband's partner's truck down to 9/11. Burns the clothes, takes the truck with the weapons, her husband's gun, her husband's partner's gun, and both of their shields down to the 9/11 site. And she walks, actually, when she gets down there, Tower 1 had already fell, and now the second tower is about to come down. And she walks through all of the debris down there and throws their shields and their guns into the murk. She goes down as the building goes down too, but she's rescued by two other cops. And that's where it kind of ends. A lot of people, you know, that saw it was like, what happens next? What happens next? I have no idea what happens next.
I saw it. It was like a cliffhanger. And I think that it was written very well because you don't expect what's going to happen next. You just don't expect it.
Right.
And so I'll be very curious to see what part two of this movie is like. And the name of that is called...
When the Dust Settles.
When the Dust Settles, yes. And I just thought that it was done very, very well. Also, you had directed by Jim Brooks as well.
That's right.
And it was actually filmed in Peekskill, was it not?
Most of it was, yes.
You know, if you live in this Hudson Valley, there are things that you will actually recognize as being in the Hudson Valley. I was very intrigued. And I have to say, I got my heart beating a little bit, getting a little tense on like what was going to happen next in this one. The part about the wood chipper, it brought to mind, I imagine people have said this to you, Derek. It makes me think of a Coen Brothers movie, The Wood Chipper.
You know what? I've never seen... To this day, I've never really seen Fargo from beginning to end. But when people mentioned it, I'm like, wow, they had a wood chipper? He said, yeah. I'm like, okay.
There was a wood chipper scene. The difference is in this movie, in Fargo, and the actress that played the cop was a woman.
Right.
The wood chipper scene was done in the snow, was sitting in the snow. So you can imagine, which is like kind of like a Coen Brothers kind of thing. They're very edgy, very edgy, you know, the way they do their thing. But let's get back to you. I don't want to start thinking about people's bodies going in wood chippers. But no, what you did actually was quite masterful. And you did have good people working with you. I recognized even some people in the cast. And the style did seem to, the direction style did seem very much like Jim Brooks.
That's right.
And that's why you chose him to do it, because he's the best.
He's the best.
He is the best. But it's true whether you like it or not, Jim.
That's right.
You know, it could be lonely at the top. But let me talk about some of the other great things you've done. You have another book that you're working on called Concrete Dreams.
Yes. Well, Concrete Dreams and my second book, which is called Dark Blue, they're actually screenplays.
Okay.
I'm a screenwriter. I've written Concrete Dreams in 1999. Actually, the way it got into book form was my wife tricked me. She read Concrete Dreams and she loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So what she did was she told me that she has a book club at work. And if I was to turn Concrete Dreams into a book, she can push it out there to all her friends and her friends will love it. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, I'm not a novelist. I don't write books. She said, why don't you just try to put it together? So that's what I did. I converted the script into a book and I sent it to her. And about 3 months later, she told me about a friend of ours that was suffering from cancer and she made a miraculous recovery. And she's like, you know, Jackie's doing much better. We're going to throw a little party for Jackie. I'm like, great. That's a real good move there. I'm down with it. It's going to be in Harlem. All right, let's go. I go to this party for Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book signing for me.
Yay! Now that's a woman. That's a woman who loves you.
Yeah, yeah. That's my baby. But she knows that I was really trying to get the word out. And where I think I messed up is that when I wrote it in 99, when I completed it, rather, in 2000, right before the 9/11 tragedy, I did what I thought every screenwriter does. And, you know, first I copy wrote it, WGA and with United States Copyright, and I made about 100 copies of the script, and I started sending them out to people who I thought would be interested. Big mistake. Huge mistake. Now, I'm sure Concrete Dreams lined the bottom of plenty of bird cages and puppy beds, but somebody read it, and lo and behold, a couple of years later, we have a show that comes out on Stars called Power. And if you was to look at everything in Power and look at everything in Concrete Dreams, you'll see the exact same story, except they changed the sexes of the protagonists. Yeah.
So they kind of got around the...
They got around me and they got around the whole copyright issue. And, you know, I'm also a private investigator.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about that as well.
Yeah. I reached out to the lawyers for Stars, and we were going back and forth on the phone for months.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought that I would be able to get to them and maybe get them to recognize that it was my work. And one day I got a call from the lawyer, and she told me that she was in the office with all the Stars executives, and they have a lot of questions, and they would like me to write down stuff. Now, I started getting a little bit nervous about that. And I made the mistake of saying, well, maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. As soon as I said that, all communication was stopped and I never heard from her again.
I think that you had the right idea by copywriting it and you had the right idea about talking to a lawyer, but you don't let people know that you're talking to a lawyer. You just do it. Now you know.
Yeah, now I know. A little bit too late, but yeah.
Well, it doesn't mean that you can't get what's yours because it is your play. It is yours. But, you know, that's unfortunate. It happens a lot, and I'm glad you're mentioning that to people that are listening because a lot of people in the arts listen to this show, and I've found that most people in the arts that I know, they have no clue about how to protect their intellectual property. And then I'll realize, I mean, the laws are kind of written so a little bit loosely, but registering a copyright is so important. I've learned the hard way. Plagiarism is something that's a constant. It's always happening. But I want to talk to you about your work as a cop, and I understand that your screenplay, or is it a book, Dark Blue, is about that. It's sort of, you know, based on your experience as a police officer.
It's loosely based on it. I became a police officer in 1986, and I really saw no future in it for me being in uniform. I recognized that very quickly, thank God.
How did you recognize it?
I just saw, you know, it's a lot of racism within the NYPD, regardless of what people say. I just happened to come into the department at a time when a lot of black and brown cops before me had smoothed the road,
mm-hmm.
if you understand.
They've
made it so that being a cop was a whole lot easier for me than it was for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they struggled and they fought back and they made it so that the new generation, which I was at the time, who came on the job, had better opportunities. Now, the opportunities were scarce for me. And I just really didn't see myself being a uniform cop for too long. So after 2 years on the job, I became an undercover cop. And an undercover cop in a lot of people's minds are, you know, the cops in the street with the shields on their necks and grabbing people and throwing them on the ground. That's not what an undercover cop is.
Tell me what an undercover cop is, Derek.
An undercover cop is a person who melds into a community that buys drugs, guns, anything illegal on the street. And you would never know that they're a cop because they'll never put the cuffs on you. They'll never pull out a shield. As a matter of fact, for the 5 years that I was an undercover cop, when it became time to wear a shield, I actually couldn't find mine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had to look for it. I actually panicked behind it for a little while, and I finally found it. But the only thing that I'd have on my person when I was going out to be an undercover was pre-recorded buy money and a gun.
Pre-recorded buy money. What is that?
Well, pre-recorded buy money, and I guess I can say this now because OCCB, which is the Organized Crime Control Bureau in New York City, was disbanded a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I would never talk about this if they were still in action. Undercover pre-recorded buy money is buy money that's basically photographed. It's photographed on a machine so that you can preserve the serial numbers.
Okay.
So I would use that money, go out, make my purchases, and I would go back to my vehicle or wherever I was, and I'd radio into the team that it was a positive buy, and I'd give a description of the people I purchased from and their locations. The field team would come in and make those arrests, and then I'd identify them shortly thereafter, you know, usually on the sidewalk.
Right.
I'd be in a car or something or across the street, and I'd give them the nod or key them on the radio and let them know that they got the right guys. And they'd go through their pockets and they usually find my buy money.
Okay, so that's the evidence.
Yeah, yeah. That's how plentiful drugs were back in the 80s when I started. It was the height of the crack epidemic.
Right, it's true. I kind of remember being in New York. I worked in New York at the time. So let me ask you a question about what's going on now. I mean, no doubt you know that there is some controversy with regard to policing and how much force should be used. And people are talking about defunding the police. And it sort of spewed the Black Lives Matter movement. How does it feel being a black cop during this time? Not that you're a cop anymore, but how does it feel as a former black cop, as a former cop, and being a black cop during all of this?
Yeah, well, what a lot of people don't realize is being a black cop, especially in New York, it was a very lonely place. You know, it was a very lonely place. You're ostracized by the black community. If you're not a snitch, you're a coon or Uncle Tom. And then the white community, they're calling you the N-word behind your back. So you were kind of on an island by yourselves, you know. But seeing all of the stuff that's happening now in the news and the abuse that the police are shelling out, it's time. It's time for a Black Lives Matter movement.
Right.
Thank God for these millennials and these Generation X kids because they're actually making it happen.
They are, aren't they? You know, it's amazing.
They're making it happen. Yeah, very tenacious. They're making it happen. I think the message is being somewhat skewed, though, through all of the violence and the destruction of property and stuff like that. Yes, I believe there was a time to destroy some stuff. I believe it was time. I mean, people don't realize that just because I was a black cop doesn't negate the fact that I was a black man before it.
Right.
I've been subjected to my share of racism both on and off the job. So, yes, it's time to get the attention of those in power. And that's what this generation seems to have done.
Yeah.
But like I said, the message is being skewed somewhat, and you can look at the cops and the things that they're doing. I mean, what Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd, I mean, on national TV.
I know, it's like one of those images, you can't get it out of your head.
Oh, you can't get it out of your head. And I'm like, you know, eyes, I mean, if you're a conscious person, you're a conscious cop at this time, you know, all eyes upon everything that you're doing. And you mean to tell me you thought it was a good idea to kneel on that man's throat like that? It boggles the mind.
Do you think I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just time. for something to happen. And that's what's going on now.
Do you think that there's some kind, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I have a brain, you know, and it works. Do you think that there it's possible that there could be some kind of covert recruitment going on within the police force to get people, to get a uniform and a badge on people that are all too happy to oppress and be violent against minorities? Is that a possibility? Because you start to think, like, how could someone like that get in there? Because I imagine that someone that has the kind of sort of psychotic nature that these cops that committed this crime against George Floyd have, that there must be some kind of a characteristic, like a psychological characteristic trait that might be, to me, it would be pretty obvious. Do you think that maybe that those kind of cops are perhaps being recruited deliberately?
Well, you read my bio. I have a business called Leverage.
Yes.
Where my business partner and I, Vincent Beckles, we go to New York City schools and we talk to the students, teenagers, about what they should and should not do to avoid being in the back of that police car. What they should and should not say to the police if they're grabbed and brought into precincts, taught them about their rights and, you know, basically how to be respectful enough to get out of a situation with a cop, because the longer you're in the same space as a cop, the more propensity violence has to possibly happen.
Why is that? Why is that?
Well, you know, we're human beings. And what people don't realize is cops have bad days, just like everyone else. You know, cops have mortgages, cops have kids and problems and demons, just like everyone else. So think about it. I'm a cop on a highway at 2 in the morning. I mean, NYPD usually has two cops in a car. But if you think about some of the places that we're hearing a lot of this violence in, one cop in a car, 2 o'clock in the morning, I pull over a car. I'm a white cop. I pull over a car with about 2-3 black guys in it. My heart's beating through my chest right now.
If you're a white cop.
I don't necessarily even have to be a white cop. I'm a cop. I'm pulling over a car at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's pitch black outside. And I got 3 guys inside that I'm not sure of what they're up to. My hand's on my gun, for sure. Now, my thing to tell young folks is, car's off, windows are down, music is off, you have your information ready. Yes, officer, how can I help you? To be as respectful as possible to get out of this situation and to get home safely. That's the name of the program. Get home safely. Now, different things happen, and you have cops that are filled with a little bit more angst than others, and they may perceive a problem or feel threatened when others don't, which may cause a problem. But my thing to people is to try to be as respectful as possible to get out of that situation, because you really don't want to be there too long. Because things may be said, different words may be exchanged, and that's going to just heighten his level of fear, and it's going to decrease the amount, the possibility that you may get out of that situation safely. But to answer your question, we try to tell young black and brown kids that if you're arrested for a felony within New York City and you plead to it, you're convicted of it, that's 35 different city jobs within New York City that you can no longer have.
Yeah.
You can no longer have. You can't be a cop. So if you think about decades of cops that may have arrested young black and brown people and have charged them with something that they should not have been charged for, and they're convicted of it, they're automatically eliminated from the pool of being a cop.
Even if they are not convicted?
No, if they're convicted or if they plead to it. Now, even I had a hard time getting on the job. I was arrested once. I was arrested once for sneaking on, twice, I'm sorry, for sneaking on the train. One time I was dead guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And the other time I paid my fare. You remember the old turnstiles in New York where you
yes.
put the token in?
Yes.
And have that big wooden, that wooden turnstile?
Yes.
Me and my mother were getting on the train at the same time. She also worked for the New York City Police Department. She got through the gate. And then, hey, I put my token in. Boom. The turnstile didn't turn. So I looked at the person in the booth. She waved to me. I ran through the gate, and there's a cop. And the cop grabs me. I'm like, hey, I just paid my fee. I talked to the booth. Y'all, I don't want to hear it. My mother was about to cry. I'm trying to get her on the train. And she went to work. And they took me to Coney Island, the base in Coney Island, and gave me a ticket. Fingerprinted me, gave me a summons. I had to explain to a room of chiefs, captains, lieutenants, sergeants in One Police Plaza and convince them to take a chance on me to become a cop. Because I had that summons.
Because that little, tiny, little thing that really hadn't even done anything wrong.
And what they don't realize is a lot of white folks don't have to go through that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Had worse records than I had. I didn't have a driver's license before I became a cop, to be honest with you. You have a lot of white guys that have like 10 tickets, 10 speeders, moving violations. Never a problem. They push right through. Us as black and brown, we had to fight a little bit more. We had to be a little cleaner. We had to be a little bit more professional than they do. And that's the truth.
As a black person, as a black cop, as a police officer, you can actually attest to the fact that there is some racism within the police force, and also that it's almost like you were profiled when you went through, when you kind of bypassed that turnstile. I mean, I remember seeing people do it on a regular basis back in the day.
Yeah, yeah. And it goes even deeper than that. When I was undercover cop, I was in Harlem, like 1989, 1990. They started something within the federal government called Federal Day. I guess the plan in motion that we never knew about was they're trying to clean up Harlem and get a lot of folks that may have had criminal records or were up to no good out of Harlem so that they can get white people in and gentrify it. We had no idea. Because trust me, if we did, we would have bought one of those brownstones for like a dollar.
Yeah.
That's what they were going for back then, that are worth like $5 million today.
Right. Literally, you know, literally, people that are listening, yeah. People listen to this show from way out of town, way out of the country. And when you tell them that they were for sale for a dollar, it's true.
Yeah, yeah. And we had no idea. I mean, I was young at the time. I was 24, 25. I was trying to save my little nickels or buy a little piece of property in Brooklyn, which I did. I had no idea that I should have invested in real estate at the time, but the government did. And what they were doing with this Federal Day was, back in those days, I used to buy a lot of marijuana. I could buy 5 pounds of marijuana from somebody on Tuesday, and it was a misdemeanor. It wasn't even a felony back then. It was a misdemeanor. But if I was to buy one bag of marijuana for $5 from someone on Federal Day, that person's looking at 1 to 3 years.
Wow. It seems very unfair.
Yeah, very unfair. They weren't doing this in any of the boroughs because I knew cops in Brooklyn in narcotics because that's where I started. I knew cops in Queens. I knew cops in Staten Island. No one was doing Federal Day but in Harlem. And you could see, now you could arrest someone for, say, an ounce of crack in Harlem back in the 80s and 90s. And that person was looking at about 3 years, 3 to 5 years. You could arrest a white guy in 1988 through 1990 for an ounce of powdered cocaine, and they'd get a misdemeanor.
An ounce. That's a lot of coke.
It's not a whole lot, but that's just what goes to show. It was,
depends. It's all relative. It's all relative.
Yeah, it was different rules to different people. You know, and that's just the truth. That's not white bashing or anything, because what a lot of people don't realize about me, I'm pro-black, but I have white people in my life that I love, like my brothers and sisters. You know, and that goes the same for a lot of white cops. There are some white cops that I would have given my life for to make sure they've come out of the situation okay, and there's some black cops that I never wanted to be in the same room with. It had nothing to do with your color. It had everything to do with your character. And that's just who I was.
You're very diverse in that. You know, I just kind of want to back off the drug talk for a little bit because I understand that, and I want the audience to know this about you because I really do admire the work that you do and the career that you've had. You're a person to be proud of because of the way you've conducted your life. And you actually won have won awards for your screenplays. That movie we were talking about before in the beginning, When the Dust Settles, you won an award at the film festival in Harlem, but it wasn't called the Harlem Film Festival. It was called the People's Film Festival. And you won an award for that film. That's quite a feather in your cap. And, you know, to be able to get something or do things in New York City, and for me, this is my opinion, I think when you do things in New York City, you know, I don't care where you're from, and I know this because I work with people from around the world, they just want to have some kind of affiliation with New York City. And you won that award for that movie. And you actually filmed it in Peekskill, New York, but what was that? You must have felt like, oh my goodness, I finally arrived.
No, not yet. And let me correct you. I didn't win that award. We won that award.
Oh, okay.
And right next to the director, we won that award. We picked up 4 awards, and it was a great feeling. But I didn't necessarily feel that we arrived. I thought that we got a little recognition for what we've done, and I was just hoping that someone with a big wallet would jump in on it and want to let us expand on the idea and go further, but that didn't happen. So, you know, that just made me write a little bit more and get a little bit more creative with what we wanted to put out there. But yes, that was definitely a team effort. That was all of our first time. James Brooks, Joe Pisano, Helen, my wife, she was executive producer. Vincent Beckles, he was executive producer. It was our first time for doing something like this, and I was more proud of the success that we all had together rather than any one of us alone. It was a great experience, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
I think that it's very important that you seem to take yourself seriously. It's so often people don't take themselves seriously with their craft, especially with the arts. And I think that I take you very seriously. I've found that a lot of people, you know, it's interesting. It seems that the people that, you know, they can do good work. It might be good, but it might be basically mediocre. And they tend to be more into the bravado over themselves. But what I've found in actually doing this job is interviewing people that are just like so incredible, so amazing, that the ones that are really something, I'll say it like that, they tend to be the most humble. There's a fine line between confidence and humility.
Right. I believe so too.
It really is. And it's a great, you know, really is. I don't know if it's I think it might even be a blurred line, but there's a line there. And I think that it's important for people out there to hear this interview with people like you so they know that they can go and do this. Because basically, this was a film, When the Dust Settles, that was done in a hometown of Peekskill, New York. A lot of people in Peekskill do a lot of creative things. There's a very, very creative community. It is, you know, and I think the world should know about it. But I got to commend you for putting this together and also aligning yourself with good people. You know, people that are talented and people that have tenacity.
That was a blessing. That was definitely a blessing. Most of When the Dust Settles was filmed in my house. And we did that to save money, of course.
What? But, that bedroom scene. That bedroom scene was pretty spicy.
What
it was
a lot
pretty
of people
spicy.
Don't realize is that we opened up the first Peekskill Film Festival. The okay. first Peekskill Film Festival was shot by Andrea. I can't remember her last name right now. I shot that show. I was a cameraman with Jim as director. And she was on the show, and she was talking about the film festival coming to Peekskill and how she's looking for African American voices and da da da. And I, you know, when we finished the show, I asked her, "Are you looking for what exactly are you looking for in your film festival?" She says, "Oh, we're just looking for something new, some new people." I says, "Well, I'm African American. James is African American. I'm like Joe is Black Irish." And we submitted our movie to the Peekskill Film Festival, and you said that we weren't good enough.
Whoa.
I never saw it. She said, "I never saw it. I have people that are doing it." She says, "Could you send it to me?" Now, this may have been a Thursday, I sent her the link to the movie. She called me on Saturday and said, and she was apologizing all over herself. I'm so sorry. We just didn't see it. Says, listen, we already have everything booked, but what we're going to do is you're going to open up the Peekskill Film Festival. You're going to be the first movie. And that's what she did. And that was a blessing. That was a blessing.
That is a blessing and an honor. And an honor for your for the whole team, for the whole...
The whole team.
The whole production company. There's something to be said about being able to pull together a production company and really pull something off. I think that there's a lot to be learned from what you've done.
Well, thank you.
For other people, seriously. So what's next for you?
Well, Concrete Dreams, my first script. What I'm actually doing, I'm trying to come up with a new idea. I have a cartoonist that drew all of the characters from the first act. And we're trying to, of course, Concrete Dreams is rated R. It's pretty serious, violence, cursing, things of that nature. And we're trying to shoot the first act and turn it into a Adult Swim type of production.
What do you mean, Adult Swim?
Adult Swim, if you've ever seen that. Those are usually cartoons of the R-rated nature.
Oh, is that what they call that? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Adult Swim. So we're putting it together because we have like 9 characters drawn. All we have to do is get a storyboard together, and I'm looking for a cartoonist. And we're ready to go. I have the voices ready. So we're ready to turn that into a 30-minute tease, or we try to get Adult Swim or HBO involved. Then I have Dark Blue. At this point, I may have gotten 5,000 or 6,000 no's already to it, but I'm sending it to everyone. I have actually have an agent attached to it.
You have an agent for Dark Blue?
I have an agent for Dark Blue. Actually, my agent for Dark Blue used to be my script coach.
Okay.
I sent her the script, and she ripped me apart initially, and we basically rewrote it. And she's so impressed by the project that she told me that if Dark Blue, when you want to pitch this to someone, because I'm going to pitch it to people, I'm going to be an agent on this. And Stephanie has been nothing but a blessing, and I really appreciate her in my life. But at this point, Will Smith's production company, Overbrook, is where I'm really trying to get this into, because I thought that him, his wife, on the same screen at the same time would have been a beautiful thing. Actually, you're not supposed to write four characters. You know what I mean? You're not supposed to have a character in mind when you're writing something. That's what I was taught. But I just totally went past everything that I've learned and wrote him, his wife, and his son actually on the same screen at the same time in Dark Blue.
Nice.
And yeah, it'll be nice if he reads it. But I'm doing everything that I possibly can.
It's hard when you deal with celebrities because they get so many scripts, but it's better to at least try. You know what my grandmother says? Nothing beats a failure but a try.
There you go.
But, you know, trying doesn't mean much until you actually do.
Got to
do it. But I really have a good feeling about your future.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I do, definitely. And I think that it's very interesting. It's just a very interesting story. I think that if someone hears this interview, I hope that it ends up being something that benefits you. It certainly won't hurt you, you know, but I think that the work you're doing, it's very gutsy. There's something very gutsy about it. That 9/11 story was very gutsy.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't know a whole lot about 9/11. They just saw what they saw in the news, and it's almost 20 years later, so they're pushed by it already because, you know, COVID is upon us. So they're not even really thinking about 9/11, but there's a lot of us that were deeply immersed in that have our ailments from it still to this day.
Yeah, were you there?
I was there for about 4 days a week for about 6 months, and then sporadically over the next year.
How are you? How are you feeling? Do you have any symptoms?
I'm feeling okay, but I have sarcoidosis in my lungs.
Oh, sarcoidosis. I know what that is.
Yeah, yeah. I have it in my lungs.
Yeah, that's a serious thing. Some people get it on the brain. Tell the audience what sarcoidosis is. It's like a scarring of tissue.
Right. In my case, I didn't realize I had it. I was about to retire in 2006. And, you know, the department recommends that you go for a full body scan. And I did it. And at this time, I was probably running about 2 or 3 miles a day. I was feeling good. I was looking good. And the doctor called me in the office and go, Derek, take a look. And I'm like, yeah, what's that? He said, those are your lungs. And it looked like ping pong balls inside of a canister. I'm like, wow, what's going on? And he told me what sarcoidosis was. So I immediately signed up with the World Trade Center treatment program. Dr. Denise Harrison saved my life. Thank you, Doc.
Yeah, what is she giving you? She's giving you special meds just for...
Well, you know, they hit me with a high... You know, at this point, it was probably 2007 then, they weren't really too sure what sarcoidosis was.
Really? It's been around for a long time.
A lot of people are born with it or developed it during their growing years, but not too many people were getting it at this time from the pile, is what we called it.
Right. Originally, yeah, and I think that there's, you have to remember, and I don't like to get too graphic because I don't want to get people turned off, but, you know, the debris that was falling from the air where people were jumping out of the tower, and the tower was burning, and then there were people in the building burning. And so the debris is a combination of jet fuel and human remains.
Well, it's jet fuel, it's human remains, it's metal, it's glass, it's wood, it's everything. It was all pulverized, and it was floating around, and we were all sucking it in because the first couple of days, no one had protective equipment. No one went down there with masks. I mean, I actually did buy a mask on the way down.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That was smart.
Yeah, I did. Well, you know, I had asthma before this, so I'm kind of used to it. But in the four of us that were in the car, we all had a mask on. But if you remember, those were some beautiful days.
The day 9/11 was the most beautiful day to wake up to.
Oh, man, beautiful days. So it was hot.
I remember it very clearly. It was gorgeous out.
Yep, it was very hot. So we took the mask off because, you know, we wanted to breathe, and we were just sucking in all the debris. And at different places, the Staten Island landfill, that was a horror story.
Yeah.
But I was a second-grade detective at the time. And I had gotten sick after going to the Staten Island landfill a couple of times. So I told my sergeant, I'm like, Sarge, listen, you know, if we're working and we got something dangerous to do, I'm the first one through a door. He says, I make just about all the collars in this office. I says, but I'm not going to the dump anymore. Find something else for me to do. So he says, hey, Derek, you're in luck. Something just opened up at the ME, the Manhattan Morgue's office. They need help down there. So I went from the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
Because now we're identifying bodies. And that was, you know, kept me from sleeping for a little while.
Yeah.
But it's life. And God is good because I'm still here to talk about it.
God is good for real. And you know, I'm sorry about the sarcoidosis. I'm familiar with that disease. What I know about it, and that's why I'm mentioning it again, is because what I know about it is the time I don't have it, thank goodness. But, you know, I was suspect to have it. It was to end up being something else. But it happens, the profile is a 38-year-old woman with hypoglycemia. And that's the profile, at least I'd say in the late 80s, that was the profile of the patient that had sarcoidosis. And now you're saying it's sort of mutated to be someone that was at the 9/11 site and inhaled all of that debris.
Right.
And it's just something to think about, and it's something to appreciate. It's another reason to appreciate the people, the first responders, for that particular tragedy. But, you know, I want to have you back on, Derek, and to talk some more, because you're so humble that you don't really express the validity of it and the gravity of things that you've done. And I hear that you kind of play it down a little bit in your part in it. But I'd love to talk to you more about that at another time on air, because you really put yourself in a situation that a lot of people would have turned on the TV set in the morning or been driving and looking in your car on the West Side Highway to see what's going on. And a lot of people just turned around and went back to Westchester, you know?
Yeah.
No, seriously. And I remember my father lived was alive. He lived uptown during 9/11. And I remember him telling me that you could smell the smell all the way from downtown Manhattan World Trade Center, and you could smell it for weeks all the way up through to Harlem. That's how pungent the air was. And you're playing it down, but I really feel in my heart that you will be blessed with good health because you were brave enough to go in there.
Come from your mouth to God's ears. Thank you for that.
And I thank you for giving me this interview. I really do. And I want to read Dark Blue. I'm going to read that book because, you know, I want to learn more about what you do. And it gives you a whole different perspective on cops, especially in 2020.
Yeah.
And how do we get a hold of you? Like, how can my audience find you and find your books? Do you have a web page or email address?
Well, Dark Blue and Concrete Dreams should still be on Amazon.
Okay, Concrete Dreams and Dark Blue, two books.
Are on Amazon.
All right, excellent.
If you go on YouTube and Google Dark Blue, Derek Wright, you should see a little trailer for that. That's also on Vimeo. And When the Dust Settles is also on Vimeo, and that's free. I never really got the books written to sell them, to be honest with you. I just wanted one person who was in a position to produce it. That's all that was for. We may have sold a couple of hundred books and stuff, but that's not really what it was for, because I think I give more away than I actually sell. I just want to come across that one person that sees the possibilities in it, sees the truth in it.
Yes, and they could be listening. They could be listening right now.
I hope so. I really hope so.
Anyway, I hope all the best things happen to you. You know, Derek, I am so impressed and so proud of you and what you're doing. And please continue to write, okay? You're very inspiring. You're very, very inspiring. And any author or writer that's out there, especially, you know, an author of color, please write, because people really, the world needs to understand what everybody's story is. I'm not going to say black or white or whatever, but, you know, I think it's very important for us all to learn about each other so we can have some empathy, so you can have some peace. And what you're doing is very inspiring. I hope that you're speaking to young kids like teenagers about what you do. Very important what you're doing.
Definitely. And I really thank you for having me on today. But I'd like to also add, wherever I go, whatever I do, and I personally believe that it's going to happen one day, that man sitting next to you, James Brooks, he's coming with me. And I tell him that. He always laughs it off. But wherever I go, he's coming with me.
The thing is, Derek, wherever I go, he's coming with me, too. Okay? So I have a feeling we're going to have to do this as a threesome. We'll work on it together. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure and in my honor. And thank you, audience, my audience, for coming to the show. And you can see that I really do enjoy doing this, especially when I have great guests on like Derek Wright. And please share this, because it's really important for people to hear experiences of other people. So please share, and please feel free to continue to reach out to me with your comments, because I'd like to hear what other people's impressions are. And until next time, and there will be a next time, I wish everybody a very safe time from this moment on. Be safe, be healthy, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.